Kia ora koutou. Thank you for inviting me and for the introduction, and thank you for coming along today. As a public historian and more recently a contract historian, I've worked on many different books, but this evening I'm going to talk about using recorded spoken material, my experiences with audio oral history interviews, in a printed form. I've had some experience over the years in using those oral history interviews and using them differently depending on what I was trying to do in the publication. In Aotearoa, oral historians who are going to archive their recordings have tended to use a time-coded summary, what we call an abstract in the trade, as an access point for interviews rather than a verbatim transcript. There are a number of reasons for this, but primarily it's because it encourages researchers who want to use the material to listen to the sound recording. As you all know, there is a huge difference between hearing someone tell their story and reading a transcript. All nuance is lost in the transcript. It's almost impossible to note silences, and it is impossible, without distracting the reader by making what you could call musical notations, to convey the emotions that might inflect the person's voice. But if you want to use a recording in printed form, you have to transcribe it. I don't know how many of you have experienced recording oral history interviews, but they tend to be wild and woolly beasts, discursive and non-chronological, and filled with hesitations and silences as narrators work out what they will tell you and how. When you listen to a recording, that doesn't matter so much, but when you try to wrangle it into coherent prose, it can be hard work. The series of books I produced while working at the Ministry for Culture and Heritage, Te Manatū Taonga, in the early 2000s was based on interviews with people who had served in the armed forces during the Second World War, with a couple of exceptions. The books were based on the different campaigns that New Zealand took part in, North Africa, Italy, the Pacific, and there were a couple of thematic ones, prisoners of war, and those who served at home in Aotearoa. Each book had an introduction which gave an overview of the subject, and then there were chapters based on an individual's interview. Before I began work on that project, I had written a book, Long Journey for Sevenpence, about the post-Second World War assisted immigration scheme from the UK to New Zealand, which ran from the late 1940s to the mid-1970s. I recorded interviews for that book as well. I used the recorded material differently in each project. When you begin a research project with a publication as the end product, there are all sorts of things to think about. And there are some extra considerations when you're using recorded interviews. Have you recorded the interviews yourself, or are you using archival recordings? How will the interviews be used? Will there be long extracts, sentences or parts of sentences, a biographical format, analysis of how the narrator is telling their story, or another way? Are you presenting the person interviewed as an individual or as a typical example of time and place? It's also really useful to have an understanding of how memory works, the degree to which memories are censored, this may depend on why the interview is being recorded and by whom, the effect of subsequent accounts of events on personal memory, Alistair Thompson's point which I'll pick up on later, and how people combine the personal and political into their individual memories. For Long Journey for Sevenpence, the numbers involved here were very large, too large for an oral history project being recorded by one person, tens of thousands of people. Yet I wanted to record some of those experiences and use them in the book. I began the project by asking people to get in touch and then sending them a lengthy questionnaire to fill in and return. The questionnaire included questions requiring brief yes-no type answers, but also allowed people to give longer, more qualitative answers if they wanted to. I ended up using a lot of material from those questionnaires in the book. It's very, very rich. But who to interview? For this book, I decided to interview people whose experiences were typical of certain experiences or time periods, or who came from typical geographical areas or occupations. I was also constrained by a lack of budget, which would have allowed me to travel outside Wellington. So the 15 interviews are a not very representative sample of the experience of tens of thousands of people. But as I said, I also had the hundreds of questionnaires I could use. In the text, I used the interviews in the same way that I used the questionnaires, for anecdotes or particularly apt phrases to illustrate a point. They were merely one of the research sources that I used, and I used them in what we might consider a traditional way. However, in Long Journey, at the recommendation of Jock Phillips, who was chief historian at the time and my boss, I included edited biographies of some of the interviewees at the beginning, before the history proper. It was a way of engaging readers and of reminding them that these were people and not just numbers. And it was a way to introduce some of the themes, such as people's reasons for emigrating, which were picked up later in the book. It was also, as I wrote in the introduction, a way to reverse the lens through which we normally look at state activity and write using the viewpoint of the people who actually emigrated. From feedback from those who were part of the scheme, I have the impression that most read those biographies and then they skip to the chapters that reflect their own time period and our experiences, and they look at the photos. So that was my first experience of using recordings in a publication. As time went on, as a result of my reading of the material produced by Alessandro Portelli, the History Workshop, Al Thompson, Joanna Bornat, Anna Green, about using and interpreting oral history interviews, my thinking about how to do it changed. So when the opportunity to be part of the Second World War project came up in 2000, I was keen to do it. I knew that I could make different books from a military historian. Those sorts of books are generally written from the viewpoint of those making the decisions. And in fact, when the project was mooted, one of the comments was that it wouldn't be possible to do such an oral history project because all the officers were dead. Standard accounts of war, intended as overviews of military action, often give the impression of the battle plans are followed, troops are moved up in order, and either succeed or are defeated. But when we interview people about their experiences, we're reminded that the experience is like for an individual. It's not straightforward. More often it's chaotic. There's danger and noise, and death, injury. Those fighting must rely on their mates, their own sense of self-preservation, and their ability to adapt to circumstances beyond their control. The books in the series are not where you'll find a great deal of information about what millimetre shells were used on board the ships which shelled Japan at the end of the war, or the types of armoured car that were used in the desert. In fact, I didn't know there was more than one type of armoured car. I got told off by one of the military historians. Morning tea. What sort of armoured car was it? He said, I don't know. I've seen more than one. But they do give you a personalised, sometimes vivid, impression of what it was like to experience those long, dangerous, tragic years, as Prime Minister Peter Fraser called them, between 1939 and 1945. When putting the books together, I had to keep in mind that each chapter is one person's story, had to be self-contained and tell a story of that particular person's experiences, but also that the book as a whole must do that too. In other words, there shouldn't be too much repetition between the stories, and the reader must get some idea of what went on regarding the particular theme of the book. As I said before, in each book, an introduction provides an overview, which contextualises the interviews. And taken together, the stories provide a faceted account of the experience of war. For each of the books, it was important that all of the significant parts of that particular experience were covered. So for The Desert Road, which is the North African book, we, and I'm not using the royal we here, these books were a real team effort of the history group and other researchers, and the interviewees, of course. These books were a team effort. We had to make sure that there was information about the Western Desert, Operation Crusader, City Rezeg, etc., time that the troops spent in Syria, breakout at Minkah Kayin, Ruwaizak Ridge, El Alamein, Takruna, all those things. So the people interviewed had to have been involved in at least one of those actions and have something to say about it. The books had to be interesting for people to read. So the individual stories had to be strong. They had to have had interesting experiences and to be reflective about those experiences. We wanted people to read those books. We also needed to ensure that the experiences of a range of units was included, not just those which provided frontline troops. So we interviewed a dentist, it was oral history after all, a chaplain, a railway engineer and drivers, all sorts of people, and included people from all around the Motu. For me, this was important for two reasons. It was a government-funded project and therefore had overtones of being official, so people from all over New Zealand needed to feel that they were involved. And second, because in some ways, I think of these books as just as much a war memorial as the built ones that we have all around the country. To me, they're another way of acknowledging and remembering the efforts and activities of those men and women who served during the Second World War. I was determined to include interviews with women as much as I could. For the Creek book, I interviewed a nurse. In the Italian book, there's a nurse and a tui. Tuis were the young women who worked in the New Zealand Forces Clubs. The North African book, there's a tui and a VAD. The POW book has an interview with a woman who worked for the YMCA in Geneva, sending parcels to the men in prisoner of war camps around Europe. And for the Homefront book, I interviewed mainly women to redress the balance of the others in the series. Well, of course, it's not really an imbalance because comparatively so few women served overseas. The Merchant Navy book, which my colleague at the time, Neil Atkinson, did, and the Pacific books have no interviews with women, and I still can't quite work out why that happened, but anyway, it did. In some of the books, for various reasons, such as shortage of time because of a very tight deadline for the manuscript, I used interviews which had been recorded by other people. For A Fair Sort of Battering, title which I've always disliked, which is about the Italian campaign, I used many interviews which Aaron Fox had recorded for a project being undertaken by Roberto Rebell, who was then here at the University of Otago. For the North African and Italian campaign books, I used interviews which Liz Catherall had recorded with former Tuis. And my colleague Alison Parr recorded interviews for the North African and the Pacific books. It's an interesting experience using someone else's interviews for a number of reasons. When you've recorded the interview yourself, you've met the person, so you know what they're like, and you can try and reproduce that person on the page. Listening to someone else's voice, listening to someone's voice gives you an idea of what they're like, but it's not quite the same as meeting them. And for some of the interviews I used, I only had a transcript, so I never actually got to hear them talking. I had to rely on a printed version of the way they spoke to try and give an impression of what they were like. Another reason is that when you've recorded an interview yourself, you know what stories are strong, which helps you when you're thinking about the overall shape of the book. By that I mean that some of these books had to cover, you know, as I said before, all the main events in a particular campaign. But it would be tedious if everyone's chapter covered all the events. So some chapters might concentrate on only one part, if that person's involvement had been dramatic or interesting or funny, and only touch lightly on the other parts of the whole campaign. When I was thinking about how the book could be structured, what order the chapters would go, what interviews would concentrate on particular events, etc., it took longer with interviews recorded by other people because I wasn't as familiar with the material that they contained. I'm going to talk a bit more now about the sort of process of writing them, I suppose. After having recorded the interviews, I always made the abstract, the time-coded summary I mentioned before. And this meant that I didn't actually have to transcribe the 3 or 4 hours that I'd recorded, because I could use the abstract and just transcribe the parts I wanted for the book. But what do you leave out and what do you put in? Most of the chapters are only 4,000 words, so when you have a 3 or 4 hour interview, this means that a lot of what has been recorded isn't included in the final publication. Once I'd done the transcripts, I then edited them heavily. I made them reasonably grammatical, but I left in things like swear words and slang because I like to keep them as close as possible to the way the person spoke. I also had to think about changes in public perception. How to deal with what we would now consider to be pejorative terms such as wog or jap. And the one that took some thought, and I didn't get it perfect and it took far longer than it should have, was how to describe fellas. I ended up using F-E-L-L-A-S, which isn't quite right,
But I used it because I thought otherwise people might read it as fullers, and I really wanted people to think of it as fullers. I would write an introductory paragraph about the person and write bridging paragraphs throughout the chapter. This meant I could move people from place to place and from incident to incident more quickly. That's to say in fewer words. I only had 4,000, remember? I would also try and leave some of the questions in to remind the reader that what they were reading is the result of an interview, that what's on the page is in response to a question that's been asked. I had to argue very strongly for that in the first book, which was the one about the Crete campaign, but I managed to prevail in the end. took some arguing. I then sent each person their chapter to read and to make alterations and amendments. Sometimes I needed to ask them to clarify things as well, particularly the spelling of names, if I'd forgotten to ask them that during the interview, but also if a sequence of events was not quite clear in the recording. As I said before, my approach to the books was very different from that of a military historian. In fact, one of my then colleagues said to me once, there's not very much war in your books, is there? Which I was quite happy about, but which also reflected, I thought, quite a narrow understanding of what war is, especially considering the amount of time that's spent by troops out of action and the number of people involved in war who are not in frontline units. As I said, I did my best to include such people. The oral history approach is excellent for recording day-to-day life, emotions, and the other things that are usually unrecorded because they are so ordinary that they're taken for granted. During the interviews and for the books, I wanted to know not only about what events the people had been involved in, but what they thought about that involvement, what it felt like to be advancing under fire, whether they'd ever felt they'd had enough, what they felt about the people they were fighting against and with, and what they felt about the people whose countries they were fighting in, what food they ate, how they washed themselves and their clothes, what they did on leave. Did the armed forces give them any advice about venereal disease and contraception? What it was like for a very, comparatively, young man from New Zealand who'd never been overseas before to experience the noise and dirt and absolute difference of a place like Cairo, or the heat and humidity and unseen enemies in the jungles of Guadalcanal. What did it feel like when you were a prisoner of war and had absolutely no control over your life and no idea of when the war was going to end? Many of the things that the people in the book lived through had been covered in other publications, such as the huge official history of New Zealand in the Second World War, which was produced by the War History Branch, the forerunner of the history group where I was working at the time, or various works covering individual battles such as Crete or Al Alamein or Casino. But a lot of those publications leave out the experiences of the so-called ordinary person, often referred to as other ranks in the military. I was interested in recording those experiences, the privates or their equivalents, who were given orders and had little, usually no, say on what those orders might be. It seemed to me that what happened to those people, and they were the vast majority after all, was very important to record if we were to gain a rounded picture of what it was like to have taken part in that war so long ago. I quoted the biographer Richard Holmes in Last Line of Defence, which is the Homefront book. And I'd like to read that to you now because to me it sums up why oral history is such a powerful means of restoring the ordinary individual's experience to history. The past, he says, is not simply out there, but lives most vividly in all of us, deep inside, and needs constantly to be given expression and interpretation. He's talking about how memory works here. He goes on to say that the lives of great artists and poets and writers are not, after all, so extraordinary in comparison with everyone else. Once known in any detail or scope, every life is something extraordinary, full of particular drama and tensions and surprise, often containing unimagined degrees of suffering or heroism, and invariably touching extreme moments of triumph and despair, though frequently unexpressed. The difference lies in the extent to which one is eventually recorded and the other is eventually forgotten. I mentioned at the beginning that one of the things I considered was whether I was going to present the experience as typical of a time and place or as an individual experience. And it was a considered and deliberate decision of mine to concentrate on the richness and complexity of personal memory, its subjectivity and partiality, and record what the English novelist Elizabeth Bowen has memorably called the edifying cathedrals and small boys of history. She says the charm, one might say the genius of memory, is that it is choosy, chancy, and temperamental. It rejects the edifying cathedral and indelibly photographs a small boy outside chewing on a hunk of melon in the dust. And in these books, I wanted to include those small boys, the day-to-day life of war, as well as the cathedrals, the danger, excitement, and chaos of being in action. I'm going to read you now an excerpt from the Italian campaign book, The Fair Sort of Battering, from an interview with Tinny Glover, which I think encapsulates both the cathedrals and the small boys. So Tinny was of Ngāti Porou. He was born and grew up in Tolaga Bay, and he served in the 28th Māori Battalion in the Italian campaign. And he's talking here about being in action after the Battle of Monte Cassino. We hopped on the truck. We didn't know where it was going to take us, but as it happened, we were confronted with a little castle town called Tavanelli. It was Sunday, and rather than go there in the dark, they sent forward a reconnaissance patrol to probe the enemy to see where they were. They went right up to this castle and heard tanks inside, so they came back and told us. It was getting dark by this time, and so we attacked straight away along a company front. And we captured the town of Tavanelli. We didn't capture the tank. That got away. It ran away. Tavanelli had a shop, I remember well. They had those steel shutters that lift up on the stores. But what we used to do was to get a landmine with a hand grenade. The landmine had TNT in it, our explosive, with a hand grenade attached to it. We'd go somewhere far away and with a line pull the pin out of the hand grenade, and that would explode and blow the shop front out. That's how we got into shops. This shop happened to be a music shop, and everybody got a piano accordion. All the jokers, beside having rifles, had a piano accordion until they got too heavy and then they threw them away. There were a lot of piano accordions in the division, and that's how they got them. They never paid for them. We went beyond there. Nepia Mahuika was our officer. We went into a grove of trees for the night, and in the morning he told us to go across the slope. We were halfway across and he said, get back, into that copse of trees. As soon as we got back, down came the screaming Mimi's six-barrel mortars and peppered the whole area. We'd all died except for Nepia. I said to him, Nep, why did you send us back? He said, well, I thought about getting the cows in Ruatoria. When I go to get the cows early in the morning, the birds are singing and they've got their wings down, drying themselves on the top of the trees in the sun. I didn't hear a bird. Now, said Tinny, that's from the old people. That's an inheritance, in my opinion. Bushcraft. He was a good man. So they continued on up the slope. There was a chap from Otago yelling out for us to help him. He was bringing a chap out. He had no legs. He'd stood on a landmine. He begged Boy Tomoana to shoot him. I don't know what happened, but he died. We took over D Company's house. Next morning, we shifted from there. We got a call that Tiger tanks were seen on the ridge, and one of our platoons was in difficulty. They were pinned down, and we had to go up and get them. I saw a lot of dead bodies on the way up, our boys. Counted about six of them. We went up a long, winding hill, and when we got up there, our 13th platoon was there. There were many casualties. The Germans led us through, three or four of us. Then our platoon sergeant was bringing up our main force, and that's when the Germans attacked him with a machine gun. Smashed his arms. It was a bloody mess. He was lying on the ground, moaning and groaning, and his brother said to me, I'm going down to look at Charlie. I said, he's all right. He's a bit over the ridge. He's lying down. But he went down to pick him up. I thought, if it was my brother, I'd go. He went to pick Charlie up, and the next minute the machine gun opened up. I said to Federal Tibble, "I've got it in my sights, Red." He said, "What the hell are you waiting for?" And I peppered the haystack and got that joker. He threw his arms up, and then two jokers crawled out and went running up the hill. One was running as if he had a crook leg, and I shot them both. I'd wondered what it was like to shoot a man. You didn't get pleasure out of it, but satisfaction that you'd done a job. So that's a real mixture of a whole heap of things in that. And I really like that extract because it just encapsulates so much about what you get when you talk to people. You get all sorts of unexpected things and you get a real mixture to construct a narrative about what was happening. And it contains everything, you know, from talking about, I don't know, family relations, from talking about what it's like to kill a man, from talking about what it's like to be under fire to looting and playing piano accordions. My own experience has not been with the analysis of how people tell their stories or reflecting on what they mean or on the significance of silences and misunderstandings in oral testimony, but I do have some experience of dealing with facts versus truth. So history is a dialogue between an historian and his sources, and nowhere is this more obviously so than in an oral history interview, where you can actually and actively question your source. But all recollections are taken from a standpoint in the present. We need to make sure that we don't fall into the trap of thinking that oral sources are unmediated. People's attitudes and political and cultural beliefs change, and this will affect what they might tell you or how they tell you about it, what they leave in and what they don't mention. As Alessandro Portelli says, oral history is not only a source of information regarding the events of history, but it can be used to discover the interviewee's attitudes about towards those events. In other words, how people rationalise and make sense of the past. While you can scan a person's interviews for facts, I would argue that the context of those facts is equally important. In other words, how a person tells their story can be as illuminating as what they're telling you. Alistair Thompson has written about memory in his book, Anzac Memories. It's quite old now, but it has really interesting things to say. He writes that memory is a process in which certain experiences are remembered in certain ways, that only a selection of an individual's experiences are recorded in memory, and that for each of these, there is a myriad of ways in which they might be articulated. Thompson then writes about the concept of composing memories, by which he means that personal accounts of the past are not produced in isolation from commonly accepted public narratives about past events, but that individuals work and fit their memories into those available public narratives. He also feels that there's an aspect of construction in this composure, in the sense that we compose a past that we can live with by perhaps forgetting unhappy or painful parts, and which gives us a sense of identity within our community and enables us to fit our experiences within those widely held attitudes towards, in this instance, the war. After the publication of one of the books, I was contacted by a number of veterans who told me that it was impossible for the experiences recounted by one of the people interviewed to have occurred. Taking into account his unit and their own knowledge of the events, he simply could not have been where he said he was and experienced what he'd told us in the interview. What to do? It's every historian's nightmare, isn't it, really? Or does it provide us with an opportunity for some deeper understanding? At the time, I told the people who contacted me that we had recorded this person's memories of this particular time and that for him, those memories were real. I don't think they were very convinced by that explanation, but I still stand by it. But while his memories were real, were they true? I began to wonder, and was that a problem? To begin with, there is the issue of truth. I know that one person's memories of an event can differ greatly from another who has experienced the same event, and that has to do with personality, with emotions, with relationships with other people involved, with age. Truth is a slippery notion when it comes to remembering the past, but as Paul Thompson has written, what the informant believes is indeed a fact, just as much as what really happened. As Alistair Thompson noted, our memories are often shaped by subsequent events. I firmly believe that for this man, he did remember that he'd been there and had experienced those events. He'd suffered terrible ongoing mental anguish from his experience, from his war experience, which I believe influenced his recounting of the story. Something along the lines of, I had to have done something worthwhile to make the subsequent anguish bearable. In Alessandro Portelli's words, it's the meaning for the person involved that is significant. Memory is not a passive depository of facts, but an active creation of meanings. In other words, people try to make sense of their experiences by placing them in storylines which make them meaningful to themselves. Anna Green's written, remembering is a complex process. Our brains do not store literal snapshots of the past that we can call up upon demand. Memories are partial and fragmented. And in the process of reassembling them for others, we decide what to include or exclude. We also seek to make meaningful connections between the present and the past. As interviewees and as writers, we learn not to confuse facts and truth. Every interview is truthful in the sense of being a true reflection of that person being interviewed by that interviewer at that particular time, in the context of the topic, the engagement between the two, how both of you were feeling on the day, what was going on in the background. Interviewees might exaggerate, or they might be so modest that they don't tell you about their heroic exploits. I've had experiences of both, but never of deliberate lying. In my experience, interviews are always a combination of facts and truth. And when we use them, when we're writing, we need to recognise that. I've lost my place now. That's terrible, isn't it? Where are we? Here we go. I mentioned the pushback I received from other veterans about that man's account of his experience in North Africa. But I think that's what he was doing. He was composing his memories in such a way to make a truth that made his subsequent mental anguish more bearable. So, are oral history recordings easy to use in publications? Not really, once you start thinking about it. But do they add richness to more conventional sources? Do they help us to understand how people remember and what they remember and how they think about the past? Hell yes. Let me finish with this piece about how wars, which while resolved collectively, are experienced individually, and how something involving such violence and suffering can also transform a person's life in a positive way. Lost my place. Sorry, talk amongst yourself a bit while I find where I'm supposed to be. Here we go. This is from an interview with Gordon Johnston, who grew up in Port Chalmers and who returned to Otago after the war. Gordon was in the 5th Field Regiment of Artillery, and here he's talking about his experiences in Trieste at the end of the Italian campaign. I thought I'd go on an exploration, and I went all the way around to a private bathing establishment called the Savoia. It was out of bounds to troops. They had sentries on, and inside they had cabins and structures built out over the Adriatic. You could sunbathe on these wolf-like things and swim, and I thought, gee, I want to get in there. There were some New Zealand sentries, but they weren't on duty there. I went over to them and I said to these guys, because I had my identity discs on, I said, could I strip off here? Yes, okay, they replied. So I stripped off. I had a bathing suit and I was as brown as a berry. I got my towel, left my gear there, and I walked up to these Tommy sentries and straight through them. Didn't take any notice of them. I looked like an Italian. There were people everywhere. There were three girls sitting near one place, and one of them asked me for a match. They were three nurses from the hospital. I liked the look of one of them especially. I couldn't speak Italian. I'd picked up the odd words, but the three of them could speak French. So we yarned away in French. I wanted to know one of them a bit more. I went there every day for a while, and Luciana and I got very cobbery. I had to take the three of them everywhere. I wanted one of them to be by herself, but these two others came. Eventually, I wrote home and told my parents that I had met an Italian girl who I liked very much. My mum wrote back and pointed out all the problems with marrying. You see, they were old-fashioned, and my mother's brother had married a Catholic person and had had a terrible time. It used to happen, and they were worried about that. But by the time her reply came, we'd already become engaged. I went to ask her mother if I could marry her. Her father was wounded in the First World War and died afterwards in about 1923, I think. I had to ask the mother, and of course the mother couldn't speak English. I couldn't speak Italian, and she couldn't speak French. So here's Luciana and her mother and me, and I asked her if I could marry Luciana. Luciana asked the mother, and I always maintain that the mother said no and Luciana said yes. The war was over and lots of New Zealanders had met Italian girls, and the New Zealand Army thought that it wasn't a very good idea. Guys had been away from female company for a long time and it'd be much better if they didn't get married. So they laid a law down that if any New Zealand soldier wanted to pair up with an Italian lady, they would give priority to go to New Zealand to engaged couples. And then he goes on to talk about how he and Luciana managed to get officially engaged. Gordon got back to New Zealand in September 1945. I bought a translation set, How to Speak Italian, and I studied that, so by the time Luciana came, we could forget our French and speak Italian. Luciana arrived in February 1946. They left Trieste and they zigzagged down Italy, picking up different war brides, till they got to the ship. She had to wait in Bari, which is in southern Italy, for a long time. They had a married lady, Mrs. Tanner, in charge of them, and she was very good to them. The people on the ship were also very good to them. My sister came with me to bring Luciana down from Littleton. We were waiting on the wharf when the ship came in, and it was having trouble berthing because the waves were quite big. My sister and I were standing there, and there were these girls waving. My sister said, there's one there, she's waving, that must be her. And I said, that's not her, she's not there. Luciana had got cold feet, and she was down in the cabin. She said she didn't get homesick until they called in at Fremantle, and it was at Fremantle she felt she wanted to go home. But my parents were wonderful, and she met the rest of the family. Luciana arrived and caused a great deal of interest in Port Chalmers. And what was fascinating, lovely for Luciana, was that they all took her to heart. Although we'd been fighting the Italians, there was no anti-feeling. I sometimes say to her, it was a great thing to leave all your family and come here to a country where you couldn't even speak the language and customs and that. She cooked different food, not nowadays, because everyone eats Italian nowadays. So it was a wonderful thing, and I often think of that. So I want to stop there on a positive experience of of being at war, and I'm happy to take questions if you have them.
Thank you very much, Megan. I will pop back over in a minute and keep an eye on the chat. In the meantime, please feel free to ask questions. I'll bring the microphone around so that people on Zoom can hear.
Just remember, I'm not a military historian.
Hi, thank you. I know very little about transcribing of oral histories and stuff, so this was fascinating to me. My question is, you said that how people tell their stories is really important and illuminating. And then earlier you said, like, in the editing process, you had this process of putting in, like, reasonable grammar. And I'm just wondering if you can say a little bit more about that, like the process of or what that means, the reasonable grammar, and what we as readers then might lose or gain from that.
Thinking about people who are going to be reading it, but also thinking about reflecting the person whose interview you are publishing, because a verbatim transcript, as I'm sure you know, everybody here who's read them, they are terrible to read. I mean, they're really very difficult, and they, you know, people stop and start sentences and they don't speak grammatically and all those other sorts of things. So they do need a lot of tidying up to make sense for a publication. As I said, you know, when you're listening to it, it's easy to follow what the person's saying, but when you're reading something, a transcript of those of spoken word, it's much more difficult. And it was also too because no one wants to have something published that reflects that is the story of their life, that is published in such a way that it's actually really difficult to read and makes them sound like an idiot, you know, or sound uneducated, or sound like they didn't know what they were talking about. So that's, again, part of the reason why I tidied up the text quite a lot, the spoken text, the transcripts.
Any other questions at all for Megan?
Oh. Kia ora. I'm curious, you said that you sent the transcripts to them and that they could make any corrections. And I was just curious as to how many corrections you got back.
Well, actually, I was really, really lucky. I mean, people were really, I mean, I think partly because I had tidied them up and so that they read reasonably. I had hardly any who wanted to change anything. I mean, sometimes it might have been because I'd got something wrong, you know, in the sequence of events, or I'd got the name of a place wrong or something like that. There was one man who, when I sent the chapter back to him, he said, "Oh, I'd never have said that. That's not what I said at all. No, you can't publish it." And so it was annoying because it was a great story. But so we talked to him about it, but no, he didn't want it because he didn't think it didn't reflect the way that he felt that he had presented his story in the interview. So we didn't publish it. So it wasn't included in the book. But not long after that, he published his own memoir. So I have a feeling that might have had something to do with it. But anyway.
Paul.
Kia ora, and thank you, Megan, for an extremely interesting talk. I haven't done much sort of oral history and tried transcribing of things, but I've done a little bit. And I appreciate your point about the work that you're doing, that you're not studying the language of those people. You're assisting them to give the account that they want to give of themselves in cooperation with your project. So regularising the language to a certain extent to me makes perfect sense, because it's going to form part of a finished product. And if they had been capable of finishing it themselves, they probably would have finished it in just the way that you finished it. My question, however, was more about you said that you weren't just interested in the events, but what people thought about the events. And there's something, it seems to me, about the interview situation and the prospect of that interview becoming part of the public record that alters people's relationship to what they say. So that if you ask what they thought about the things that they are involved in, there's a sense that they're partly wanting to tell you what they think you want to know about what they thought, so that, okay, they very seldom will claim to have done things or been at events that they weren't at, although I did have an extremely memorable experience of somebody telling me something that was completely wrong and that I found her out in. And it was a very bonding thing for her to find out that I could find out things like that. Yes, to find that when you ask what people think about things that they've been involved in, well, they might have thought something different at the time, but 50 years later, they possibly know that they ought to be thinking something a little bit different, and they might want to sort of correct the bad or inappropriate thought patterns of their younger selves and tell you something that might be more in accordance with what you or their readers might want to hear. What do you think about that?
Well, that was the point I suppose I was trying to make, in the sense that, you know, the present affects very much what people are telling you, and that people construct and compose their memories over time in reaction to the subsequent events in their life, but also in reaction to the sort of public narrative of what, you know, how something might be treated. So in this case, the Second World War, or the, you know, the Battle of Monte Cassino, whatever it might be. So yeah, absolutely it does. And it depends a lot too on who's doing the interview. I mean, I was a, how old was I at the time? Probably in my 40s, woman, never had any experience of being, you know, in the armed forces or being in the military. Wasn't born till the war had ended. There were these very old people telling me these stories. Of course, I was a woman, you know, it affected a lot what they told me. If I'd been a person the same, if, you know, if we'd been down at the RSA and I'd been a person the same age, the stories would have been very different. Or the stories themselves might not have been different, but the way in which they were told would be very different. And the things that were emphasised and the things that were left out would be very different as well. So I think, you know, absolutely it does. The fact that I was working for a government agency, the fact that the books were, that they were going to be published in a book, all these things affected what these people told me and what they told me they thought about what was happening to them at the time. And of course they were, what, 50 years older than they had been then. So, you know, that, of course that's going to affect how they think, how they reflect.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Fiona.
I'm interested in the act of listening. I'd like to know how you, as the listener, were affected. What were the most profound things that changed or surprised or awoke something in you by doing this process? Because you're not just an objective recorder, you're a person. So could you talk about that a little?
Yes, well, to be brutally honest, I've done so many interviews, I very rarely remember them. So they're just, there's all this, it's just a sort of melange of stuff in my head, which I very rarely remember the details of them. But I think when I was doing the Second World War project, the book that affected me the most was the one about prisoners of war, because their stories were so very different. You know, they'd gone there for a reason, and they wanted to engage with the enemy, as they called them, and, you know, they wanted to take part in this big thing that was happening, and then they ended up in a prison camp, and they had no agency whatsoever. They had no say over, you know, what was going to happen in their life. They were very hungry a lot of the time, and one of the things that really struck me for some reason, and it was the same with everybody, of course, who was there, but for some reason it really struck me with the Prisoner of War book, is that someone said to me, and of course we didn't know when the war was going to end, so, you know, they had no idea how long they were going to be imprisoned. So I suppose of all of them, that was the thing that probably struck me the most. But in terms of listening, I mean, you don't get to be a decent oral historian unless you are an actively engaged listener, and it's really full on, you know, the whole sort of concentrating on this person and thinking about what you're going to ask next, and, you know, how, what it is they're telling you, and, you know, you have your list of things that you want to cover, but they've gone off on some sort of sidetrack, and you think, oh, and, you know, I've only got 4 hours here, do I really want to go there? Or, but often it's, you know, that's when you get the gold. So it's no sense even trying to be an interviewer without being an active and engaged listener.
Any further questions? Sarah.
You talked about trying to choose typical stories, but of course everyone's telling their own story. Did you have a sense with your veterans of ones who were trying to speak for others, perhaps ones who hadn't come back, and to the extent to which they wanted to tell their own unique story and how they saw that role?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think, yes, I think so. I mean, I think for some of them, it was the opportunity, and they saw it as an opportunity to talk about experiences they'd been in where possibly, you know, one of their friends had got killed or something like that. So it was an opportunity for them to talk about that person in the context of whatever it was that was happening at the time. So I think it was interesting to me about people talking about their going to Anzac Day parades and ceremonies, because most of them, almost everybody I interviewed said they didn't go there to expect to be made a fuss of because of their experiences during the Second World War. They went there to remember their friends who didn't come back. So that I think is part of the question that you're asking. You know, that was that sort of memorialising of friends who died. I think that was part of the experience and part of the reason for them, you know, talking to me too. Yeah.
Laura.
I'm really interested in finding out more about what makes a good candidate for interview. Often it's difficult for people to share. And what are some of the tips to ensure that you're going to be able to enable that story to come out of them? If there is some reticence, what's the criteria that you took when you were asking for people to interview?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear.
So what makes a good candidate for interview?
Right. Well, it was a bit difficult in this sense because the numbers were so great. I mean, it was the same with the assisted immigration book, but with the war one as well, the numbers were so great. So I did rely on those written questionnaires because I used them for the war books too. And sometimes it didn't work out particularly well because sometimes people write much better than they speak, you know. And it also did mean that there were people who maybe didn't have particularly good writing skills, but who actually would have been terrific to interview, but we didn't for some reason. So there was a lot of sort of thinking about what we thought were the sort of prime events that had happened in a particular campaign, and then reading through the questionnaires and getting people whose stories reflected those or who thought about them in an interesting way, not necessarily because they'd been there, but maybe, you know, they had something interesting to say about them. So that was how we chose people. So we actually chose them from the written word. When you're actually in an interview, sometimes it's quite difficult when you get there. I have had a couple of experiences where I've arrived at an interview and it's just, I've realised after about 5 minutes that it's not going to be great. you know, people will answer questions yes or no and various things like that. So it's really difficult then because particularly for that project, you know, it was kind of, they knew why I was there and they had the expectation that their interview would be produced in a book. So it wasn't always a happy time, but but yeah, and yeah, we chose them from the questionnaires, yeah.
Thank you. Look, there's...
Yeah, sorry. Sometimes I had to actively try and find people. So for the woman in the books, for the woman who did the parcels for the prisoners of war, I found out about her through somebody else who knew her and had known about her, and I thought, right, that's interesting, we'll have her. So, yeah.
Thanks, Megan. Chef, there's a couple...
I have two questions from online. One is from Joan McCracken. She says, thank you, Megan. That was fascinating. Have you continued to use oral histories as the basis for your later books?
No, I haven't actually. I haven't used it very much in the more recent things I've done. They've been a bit more sort of traditional historian sources, archives, you know, secondary material, those sorts of things.
Okay. The second one is from Chloe Coombe. And she says, hi, Megan, I'm interested in the story you told about the soldier who may have misremembered his experience during the interview, in quotation marks. Have you experienced this in others or different interviews in later work? And do you think this has to do with trauma surrounding the event being interviewed about? And you said something about that, but if you want to elaborate.
I missed what it was, sorry.
To what extent the misremembering is due to trauma?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It was really, really obvious in that particular instance because of just the person and his presentation. I didn't actually do that interview, but his presentation and his presentation of himself and how he spoke. And again, what he'd written in his questionnaire was really, really interesting. But it was also obvious from the questionnaire that he had found being back in civilian life after the war very, very difficult. And so that was actually one of the reasons why we decided to interview him. But it was a very difficult interview to do. But I hope he got something out of it, some sort of that he felt that he'd made a contribution that possibly he knew he hadn't in other ways. I don't know. Memory and trauma, it's a hard one, isn't it? I mean, it's not my area of expertise. There's probably people in this room who'd be able to speak about these sorts of things better than me, but it's I think it all comes back to what Al Thompson was saying about people trying to construct a story of their life that makes it bearable for them and makes them able to live with themselves, basically. You know, not everybody has bad experiences during the war, but quite a number of the people that we interviewed found it very difficult to settle back into life after they'd come home. And that actually was one of the things I was really interested in and making sure appeared in the books, because it is hard. I mean, it's really, really hard. And you know, you can't produce histories of people being at war without reflecting on the effect it has on the individual, and not only the individual but their families when they come home too.
Thanks, Megan. Any other questions at all? Sorry, I've been told.
Oh, you've got to stand where the thing
and
is.
There. Look, I've just got a personal anecdote. I was one of the pupils from Megan many, many years ago. When I was working on Frank Reed and his collecting of Alexander Dumas, Frank Reed was the older brother of A.H. Reed, the publisher. And I found out that Frank's youngest daughter was alive in Tamarunui, my hometown. And so I had to go and interview her. I wanted to go and interview her. So there was no choice. It was just a matter of trying to get there. And Megan had given me a set of rules of what to do and what not to do. And I sat there with Mrs. Bycroft, Laurel Bycroft, and interviewed her. And she was very angry at first because she wasn't really wanting to discuss her father's interests in Dumas. She didn't like Dumas. She preferred Dickens. I was in the middle of Tamarunui sticking a microphone on this 84-year-old woman's blouse, and I gave her a piece of paper. Megan had told me list of questions, etc., have some sort of direction. And so she continued to hit this piece of paper on the microphone all the way through the interview, as well as the damn cuckoo clock that was going. But it was a wonderful experience, my only time, but it was a great, a rich resource that I was able to use for my personal studies. So thank you, Megan. Any more? Well, on that note, look, I'd like to ask you to thank Megan again for another stimulating talk tonight.